Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Attorney General David Yost in August joined the Trump administration in arguing that federal civil rights laws do not protect LGBTQ employees against discrimination in the workplace. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act forbids, among other things, discrimination against workers based on sex. And what that means will be argued before the Supreme Court in October. Ohio is one of 28 states that have no workplace protections for LGBTQ employees unless they work for the state. The Attorney General's office declined our invitation to have Dave Yost or anyone representing him join the show today. Emma Green is a reporter for The Atlantic. She's been covering the story. Welcome to the show, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're talking about the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's a familiar federal law. It bans employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, and sex. And the question is whether sex also includes sexual orientation. What are the cases that attracted the Supreme Court's attention to this?
So we have coming up this fall a huge blockbuster case that the Supreme Court will hear that concerns a funeral home. And it's essentially challenging an interpretation that's long been put forth by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that argues that, in fact, Title VII already protects people who are transgender or have a non-gender conforming identity. And what we'll really try to deduct or deduce from this hearing at the Supreme Court is whether the law already has gotten us to a place where we don't have to have these battles over identity anymore, or whether truly Congress is going to have to pick this back up and make clear whether or not existing civil rights protections protect LGBT people.
So the Solicitor General of the United States is going to be arguing on behalf of the funeral home then in this case?
Yes. What we have seen from the Trump administration is signal after signal in briefings, in letters that they've written from different departments, that they line up with the side of not only the funeral home in this case, but generally conservative legal advocates who say that civil rights protections do not cover sexual orientation and they do not cover discrimination on the basis of gender identity. So definitely the Trump administration will be putting its weight on the side of that argument.
And then let's talk about the front of the court brief that Ohio joined in on. How many other states have done that? And what's the sense about why they're doing it? Is it just for clarification of the laws, or is it something else?
So the state-by-state battle here is one of the most important and I think least well-understood aspects of this fight. We are in a place in the United States where 20 states fully prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, and 28 states don't at all. So what we have here is a patchwork of protection where, depending on where you live, it could mean the difference between having legal recourse if you believe that you've been fired because of who you're married to or how you dress in the workplace, or absolutely having no recourse at all. And so I think that's where the state's motivation comes in. All of these state-level litigators see the need to get this resolved because the current situation is chaotic and very confusing, I think, for Americans.
Is it the case that in some states what they've done instead of, say, joining this friend of the court brief is actually pursuing state protections?
Yes. And what we've seen, especially in the lead up to that momentous Supreme Court decision in Obergefell in 2015 that legalized same-sex marriage around the country, was a lot of state-level action to put these protections in place. And we have seen some of that in the 4 or 5 years since that decision. But the real truth of the matter is that from a legislative perspective, these issues are at a standstill. At the state level and at the federal level, legislative bodies have been unable to come to any kind of consensus or collaboration to figure out some sort of long-term fix for clarifying what kinds of rights LGBT people have in the workplace, in housing, and in the public accommodation sphere.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost in August joined the Trump administration in arguing that federal civil rights laws don't protect LGBTQ employees against discrimination in the workplace. We're talking about the question before the U.S. Supreme Court in October is what do they mean by sex in the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which forbids discrimination against workers based on sex. Ohio is one of 28 states that have no workplace protections for LGBTQ employees unless they work for the state or happen to work for a company that bans it and that sort of thing. The Attorney General's office declined our invitation to have Dave Yost or anyone representing him join the show. Emma Green is my guest right now. She's a reporter for The Atlantic, and she's been covering this issue. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I mentioned that some states already have laws, Emma Green. Some really large corporations, in fact, many, already protect their employees on this basis. But so we're talking about really the realm of smaller businesses across the country, right?
Right. And we see this in the funeral homes case that's going to be coming before the Supreme Court this fall. That's a classic example of the type of family-run business that does have quite a number of employees who can make a really big impact on their employees' life depending on the types of rules or accommodations they're willing to make. So it really is that small business and sort of the businesses that exist outside of these coastal big corporations that have jumped on board with the LGBT rights movement, not all of these companies are lined up behind trying to develop policies of their own to put protections in place.
They just said they endorse such policies.
Yeah, I would say that in general, corporate America has led the way on not only putting policies in place voluntarily that would protect LGBT employees because they're trying to attract talent and signal where they are, but that isn't a uniform story. The economic life of the United States is hugely diverse, and there are a lot of companies that haven't taken this step for political reasons or because it's expensive and complicated to put in place new protections that may have to be litigated or dealt with by an HR department. So we really still are in a kind of wild, wild west where depending on where you work and where you live, your protections might be wildly different.
How has the president responded to questions about this effort by his administration?
So President Trump has done a little bit of a dance on LGBT rights. When he was first elected, LGBT advocacy groups were very scared and sounded the alarm bell that he was going to absolutely roll back their rights. He has tried to, at least rhetorically, be an ally to the LGBT community. He makes statements sometimes, he'll tweet sometimes purporting to support LGBT rights. But what's happened, and I've documented this in my reporting, is that across his administration, executive agencies and their leaders have put in place policies that essentially walk back protections that the Obama administration had put in place. And so in terms of any kind of proof on the ground that the administration is trying to advance LGBT rights or resolve this wild, wild west of rights that we're living in today, there's very little proof that they're actually fighting on the side of people who are in the LGBT community.
Can you give me an example of how the administration and executive agencies have walked back protections from the Obama era?
Yeah, so a lot of this has revolved around the question of religious freedom or claims of religious freedom. One big example was that the Department of Labor recently rescinded it strengthened this ability for religious groups to hire and fire people based on their religious teachings. And the Obama administration had kind of pushed back against that and put in place a blanket rule that said that any kind of government contractor or subcontractor had to protect LGBT rights, couldn't discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity. So that was one big example. The other is in healthcare. We've seen that the Department of Health and Human Services has really taken this issue on. They rescinded an interpretation of the Affordable Care Act that under Obama had basically ventured to say that LGBT rights are protected in healthcare settings. And they've basically said, no, we don't interpret the law that way anymore. So we really see this happening at the level of administrative law, those executive agencies fighting out this issue.
When asked about this, the president touted his endorsement by the Log Cabin Republicans. That's a national LGBTQ organization. That endorsement has created divisions in the group, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We saw the longtime head of the Log Cabin Republicans actually stepping down because that was basically not true that the Log Cabin Republicans had come out in favor of Trump and his policies. So,
so that there isn't an endorsement. That's not accurate.
Right, exactly. Okay. And it was contested. And I guess the point is that there are definitely gay Republicans who have come out in favor of Trump and mm-hmm. side with Trump. But there's a lot of ambivalence, I think, among gay conservatives in particular about what this administration is going to mean for the causes that they want to see championed by the Republican Party, which is LGBT rights.
James Essex, director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBT and HIV project, said last spring that if the court sides with the administration, it would relegate LGBTQ people, quote, around the country to a second-class citizen status. It sounds like they're already in that status, if it is the wild, wild west in the patchwork quilt you describe.
So we're in this sort of ambiguous place where the Supreme Court has not come down definitively on one side or the other of this big interpretive debate that's been going on at the lower courts, which is, what does the law say right now? What do we already have in terms of protections? And I do think that LGBT advocates are fearful that the conservative court is going to civil rights statutes and say, you have to have something explicit from Congress. You can't just read this into the text of the law that was passed 50 years ago when these issues were thought about in radically different ways. So I think what the next step will really be is looking to Congress to say, will our nation's federal lawmaking body take action to make a clear law that says one way or another what the protective status is for LGBT people in our law?
What's your wager on that one?
It depends on the election. I think in 2020, if the Democrats were to do very well, they were to maintain the House and they were to win back the Senate, I think that this would be top of the agenda. And one of the signs that we have to suggest that is what happened this spring. There was the introduction of the Equality Act in the House, which was passed overwhelmingly by Democrats, but was basically dead on arrival in the Senate. And I think that bill was meant as a signaling device. It was to suggest this is high on our agenda. We can't get it done right now. But if we have the ability, if we have the seats in both of these chambers, this is absolutely going to be something that we take on.
So the Equality Act in the House is that would resolve this question.
It would, although it may introduce other tensions. So the Equality Act is something that's been floating around in different forms for decades. And basically what it would do is spell out in very clear terms that in housing, in hiring, in public accommodations, the law protects against discrimination, against sexual orientation and gender identity on those bases. But one of the distinctive features of the Equality Act, as it was introduced and passed by the House this spring, is that it has no religious exemptions whatsoever. And so, you know, in my world, I cover religion and politics. There are a lot of organizations, from Christian colleges to Christian businesses and nonprofits, hospitals, that are very worried that if this bill comes and gets passed in 2021, say, without any kind of space for religious exemptions, that could leave a lot of organizations stranded trying to follow their mission and follow their beliefs, but also trying to follow the law.
And then just before I let you go, any sense about what the American public thinks about this issue?
You know, this was one of the most interesting findings of some of my recent coverage. Roughly half of Americans think that federal law already, in a very straightforward way, bans discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And this is pretty incredible to me because, first of all, half of Americans are wrong. That is not true about federal law and where we're at. But it also, I think, speaks to this moment that we're in, where America has changed so much. Public opinion has changed so much on same-sex rights, same-sex marriage. And yet, we kind of haven't resolved the legal issues that big decision introduced.
Well, I'm just wondering if that's the same thing as a lot of issues nowadays. The public is in a different frame of mind than Congress, or at least Senate.
I think that's right. I think that in terms of public opinion on LGBT rights, in general, we've moved from a place over the last two decades where it was unthinkable that there would be legal same-sex marriage and protections in some places for LGBT people, to a place where part of that really is in place, and many Americans want that to be the case. But I also think that this issue has slid down the agenda list of a lot of Americans and how they're voting and thinking and advocating, because they kind of assume it's been resolved, even though it has not.
Emma Green, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Emma Green is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She covers politics, policy, and religion, and she's been covering the case of the cases before the U.S. Supreme Court coming up in October that questions whether or not Title VII of the Civil Rights Act includes sexual orientation in its ban on discrimination against workers. We're talking about what that means, and we're talking about what the arguments are today. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, if you've been feel like you've been discriminated against because of your sexual orientation, and can give us an example of how it affects your life. And if you have any questions, please feel free to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost this summer joined the Trump administration in arguing that federal civil rights laws don't protect LGBTQ employees against discrimination in the workplace. So Title VII of the Civil Rights Act forbids, among other things, discrimination against workers based on sex. What that means exactly will be argued before the Supreme Court in October. Ohio is one of 28 states that have no workplace protections for LGBTQ employees unless they work for the state. The Attorney General's office declined our invitation to have Dave Yost or anyone representing the office on this issue join the show. Ohio State Law Professor Mark Spindleman's scholarship focuses largely on questions of inequality, often in the contexts of sex, sexual violence, and death. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann, for having me.
Peter Sprigg is Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at the Family Research Council, which supports the view of the Trump administration that federal civil rights laws don't protect LGBTQ employees against discrimination in the workplace. Welcome, Peter Sprigg.
Thank you for having me.
Peter, I want to clarify, there's the interpretation of the law and then what your organization believes should be the law. So one can say that Title VII doesn't cover sexual orientation, but say they do support workplace protections for LGBTQ employees in the U.S. Is that the case for your organization?
Well, Family Research Council agrees with the Trump administration with regard to the legal issue before the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. that existing law does not incorporate sexual orientation or gender identity as protected categories. But we at Family Research Council also oppose including those as protected categories by legislative means as well. We believe that legislatively would be the only legitimate way to add those protected categories, but we believe that that would be unwise public policy.
Why?
Well, first of all, we believe that these laws are not justified in principle. We have to remember that all non-discrimination laws interfere with the freedom of some other entity, in this case of employers or of businesses. So it's not a win-win situation. It's a zero-sum game where if you are increasing protections for one group, you are taking freedom away from another. And because of that, because of this zero-sum game, the burden of proof always has to rest on the people who want to add a new protected category. And generally speaking, in our history, with categories like race and sex, we have created these protections for personal characteristics that are inborn, involuntary, immutable, innocuous, and or in the U.S. Constitution. And all of those criteria would apply to a characteristic like race or sex. None of them apply to the behavioral choices that are involved in homosexual conduct or transgender conduct.
So that's your interpretation of homosexuality, though, that it's a choice. It's not...
The conduct is a choice. The attractions, I believe that sexual orientation is not one thing. It's actually an umbrella term for a person's sexual attractions, their self-identification, and their sexual behavior. I would not claim that a person's sexual attractions are a choice, but their behavior and their self-identification are a choice.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Peter Sprigg. He's Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at the Family Research Council in Washington. Also with us, Mark Spindleman, Professor of Law at Ohio State. Mark Spindleman, what about that issue, the issue of the zero-sum game and that an increase in protections for one group is taking freedom from others? Is that, where does that principle stand in law right now?
Well, you know, that's certainly one way to understand what anti-discrimination laws do. But some of this, for most people, most of the time, comes down to the question of what that kind of freedom to discriminate actually means and whether it's in fact legitimate. And on the thought that, say, sort of consistent with this principle that was just being described, laws that prohibit discrimination on the basis of race or sex are not simply equality or freedom enhancing measures, but they're freedom constraining measures. We don't ordinarily think of a right to be to engage in race-based discrimination as a protected form of freedom that's equivalent to the right to be free from that kind of discrimination. So it is certainly possible to describe them as equivalent forms of freedom so that they're sort of trade-offs and zero-sum games. But we have a long history in our country of not regarding the right to be free from race discrimination or the right to be free from sex discrimination as the same as the right, the freedom to engage in those forms of discrimination. We think that those forms of freedom are actually not, we don't typically call them freedoms.
Equal.
We don't typically call them freedoms. We call them discrimination and we call them harms, that the state has a well-established sort of practice of seeking to combat.
Peter Spriggs, the Columbus Dispatch, well, the Ohio Attorney General David Yost said that he joined that front of the court brief filed by other states arguing the 1964 Civil Rights Act prohibited discrimination based on gender doesn't apply to those who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. He said it's up to Congress and not the judiciary to write laws expanding such protections. What are you hoping for, that the Supreme Court doesn't say anything, that the Supreme Court clarifies one way or the other and clarifies that this is not an expansion of protections?
Certainly our hope would be that the Supreme Court would say that when Congress enacted the Civil Rights Act of 1964 forbidding discrimination on the basis of sex, it was not their legislative intent to forbid discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Discrimination on the basis of sex occurs when men are given an advantage over women or women are given an advantage over men. And that is not what we're talking about when we talk about sexual orientation and gender identity. So certainly we would hope that the court would rule that way, would take a restrained view and not expand the meaning of the word sex beyond what it meant in 1964. I think that would be a violation of their appropriate role as judges.
And Mark Spindleman, what are the different iterations that the court could apply in this case.
So it is one form of argument that you just heard is that the court should focus on, in a sense, the original intention or the original understanding or the legislative idea behind enacting Title VII with its sex discrimination provision. Another view, that view leads to the conclusion that the kinds of protections that are being sought on behalf of lesbians and gay men and trans folk are not encompassed by Title VII sex discrimination provision. There is another view, I think it's the right view, that takes a look at the text of the law and sees that it prohibits sex discrimination and follows the principles of the earlier cases and the ideas of them, which in various ways point to the conclusion that anti-lesbian, anti-gay, and anti-trans discrimination are forms of sex discrimination. If that's the case, then it looks like it's a form, in a sense, of discrimination to take lesbians and gay men and trans folk out of the realm of protections under Title VII's sex discrimination rubric.
What's the principle that they are forms of sex discrimination?
Okay, great question. So there are a couple of different kinds of arguments. One kind of argument you heard from your other guest, that's one kind of argument. I'll give you a couple of others that are fairly standard in this area. One is what's called a quote-unquote but-for test. The question here is we seek to test whether somebody has been discriminated against because of their sex if the discrimination would not have happened but for their sex. So, for instance, somebody who is lesbian or gay, we'll call her Jane, is being discriminated against because she's a lesbian is the idea. And the question is that sex discrimination? One can very easily and sensibly and rationally and straightforwardly say that if Jane had had an attraction to or an identification as a non-lesbian,
If she were a man attracted to a woman.
Perfect.
Okay.
If she were a man attracted to a woman, she wouldn't have suffered that form of discrimination. Therefore, the discrimination against her is, but for her sex, she wouldn't have been discriminated against. Therefore, it's sex discrimination. Another way of describing or coming to the same conclusion about Title VII sex discrimination provision applied in Jane's case is to understand there's a famous case called Price Waterhouse against Hopkins in which the Supreme Court says sex stereotyping is impermissible. So the idea here is similar. Jane would be protected by Title VII sex discrimination prohibition because the discrimination that she's experiencing because she's a lesbian woman has to do with stereotypes of how women are supposed to be. In a normative view, women are not supposed to be lesbian women on this sort of very traditionalist sexist view. And so it's covered under Title VII sex discrimination provision very straightforwardly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Peter Sprigg, what do you make of that?
Well, as I indicated, I understand that that's the argument being made in the court case, but we would disagree with that and say that you only have sex discrimination if one sex is being given an advantage over another. So if lesbian employees were being favored over homosexual males, then there would be a case for sex discrimination. But if heterosexual women are being favored over lesbians, that's not sex discrimination. That's sexual orientation. That's a different category.
Okay, and so that's not the stereotyping of sex. That's not taking place. You're saying you do understand that argument. You just disagree that it applies.
Right. And with respect to the stereotyping, mm-hmm. I think that actually, now I'm not a lawyer, I have to qualify that, but I went back once because I always heard this people talking about this Price Waterhouse case. I went back and actually read the case, and I was surprised because the sex stereotyping issue is not central to the actual finding in that case. It was found in a passage that is not even a majority opinion. It's a plurality opinion. So I think actually entirely too much weight is being placed on Price Waterhouse. That's my opinion as a non-lawyer with respect to sex stereotyping. I think that if you look in the context of that case, you're dealing with a situation with maybe a female employee who was criticized for not wearing enough makeup or something like that. That's quite different from this entire category of sexual orientation or gender identity.
I wanted to ask you something that I keep, it's kind of in my mind, and I understand you've already made the distinctions about why race and gender should be protected. But what about an organization, a company that subscribes to a religiosity, a religion, a doctrine that believes that women should not be in the workplace?
Well, I'm not either,
but I'm just kind of wondering how that works.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there are certain jobs that can be reserved to men within religious organizations if that's part of their doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, part of the concern about this, both with respect to the court cases and with respect to the Equality Act in Congress, is that there would be a conflict with religious liberty, and that the result could be that churches, synagogues, mosques, and other religious nonprofit organizations could be forced to do things that actually violate their religious freedom, that violate their free exercise of religion under the First Amendment to the Constitution, if they're required to treat homosexuality the same as heterosexuality, for example. And so I think that's one of the big concerns that we have about the implications of this case as well.
Yeah, and Mark Spindleman, is that, you know, that example when it comes to why you would oppose hiring or why you would fire somebody if religion is at the basis of it?
I think there's lots to say about this. So I think it's understandable that some people of faith and faith leaders would have the kinds of questions that your other guest is describing about a ruling in favor of the LGBT folks in the cases that are coming that are before the court. That said, there are certainly well-established constitutional and other kinds of protections for religious organizations, for churches and other religious institutions, so that, you know, the concerns, although understandable, are also, you know, quite predictably resolved in ways that ought to be reassuring to people of faith and faith leaders.
Hmm. Peter Sprigg, I have to let you go, but I do appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Peter Sprigg is Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the Trump administration arguing that federal civil rights laws do not protect LGBTQ employees against discrimination in the workplace as it relates to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The U.S. Supreme Court in October will hear arguments about what is meant by the word sex in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, coming up in October, as I said. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost in August joined the Trump administration in arguing that federal civil rights laws do not protect LGBTQ employees against discrimination in the workplace. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act forbids, among other things, discrimination against workers based on sex. And what that means will be argued before the Supreme Court in October. Ohio is one of 28 states that have no workplace protections for LGBTQ employees unless they work for the state. The Attorney General's office declined our invitation to have Dave Yost or anyone representing the office on this issue join the show. Still with us is Ohio State Law Professor Mark Spindelman. His scholarship focuses largely on questions of inequality, often in the context of sex, sexual violence, and death. Thanks again for joining us, Mark.
Nice to be here, Anne.
Elena Yocum is an attorney and executive director of Equality Ohio, which supports the federal protections. She joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, and a pleasure to be here.
Elena, some legal scholars believe that Chief Justice John Roberts might act as a swing vote and rule in favor of LGBTQ protections, resulting in a 5-4 decision. Is there any evidence? What are your senses about where the players stand in this in the court?
We have heard some hopeful prognostications that perhaps the court will go in favor of supporting an expansive interpretation of sex that frankly has been interpreted by several courts for some time now. We are hopeful that that will in fact be the case. But even if the court were to rule in favor of sex, including sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes, to some degree that would really just maintain the status quo. It would certainly give clarity, but it doesn't necessarily eliminate the need for things like the Ohio Fairness Act, which would explicitly add sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes under state law.
Why is that? Why wouldn't it have overarching implications for states that don't have protections?
Yeah, great question. And that's because this is really focusing on workplace protections. Title VII is focused on employment. In fact, we are seeking protections in housing and in public accommodations. Federal public accommodations law, for example, doesn't protect based on sex. So this can't extend to that service industry at the federal level by implication. Additionally, there are differences between state and federal law. State law protects workers who are in workplaces with 4 or more employees, and federal starts at 15. So we still need these protections at the state level, even if we get a favorable ruling.
Mark Spindelman, do you agree with that?
So it's certainly the case that there are regularly, in the context of anti-discrimination law, overlapping protections between federal protections and state protections. And part of what I take the idea here to be is that state protections are still necessary because they cover things that the federal anti-discrimination rubric wouldn't, and so matter quite importantly at the local level. So there are multiple kinds of protections, different kinds of recourse that people have. The federal law, even if it is understood to sex discrimination is included, understood to include anti-gay and anti-trans discrimination, doesn't do the extra work that was just being described at the state level.
And, you know, Elena Yocum, others believe that justices might send a mixed message ruling in favor of protecting gender identity, but not sexual orientation. That sounds confusing. What's the distinction?
It does. And frankly, that's the place where we are right now. We have some courts, more courts, frankly, recognizing that it's very hard to extrapolate someone's gender identity from sex, that really that is sex discrimination. In Ohio, we have the Smith decision, which for more than 10 years has been in place and said transgender people are simply protected under sex discrimination. But we're in a circuit, in the Sixth Circuit, where we actually have a circuit split. We have the Vickers case, which said, no, sex discrimination doesn't protect based on sexual orientation. And frankly, my reading of the case, they have to somewhat do gymnastics in order to come to that conclusion. So yes, we could see a decision that goes in one way for sexual orientation and a different way for gender identity or expression. Hopefully, we're going to see a ruling that brings clarity and simply sees both as protected sex discrimination.
So Mark Spindelman, is there any precedent for kind of a split decision like that and splitting the hairs as such as they are?
Yeah. So the precedent is, you know, sort of at least at the circuit
at the circuit level
is,
already.
It's just, yeah, it's already there. It is pretty clearly confusing, or might be confusing to lots of people in the public. How is it that anti-trans discrimination is protected but anti-gay discrimination is not, if that's the way that the court should rule? A much more straightforward way for the court to decide it would be to handle both and along the lines, hopefully, of the arguments that are being made for inclusion here.
What relevance does the Obergefell case have on all of this?
Both lots and nothing.
Okay.
So technically, the case is a statutory interpretation case involving the meaning of this provision of a federal law enacted by the Congress, signed by the president. Obergefell involved a constitutional question about the meaning of the 14th Amendment and its due process clause and its equal protection clause. So in a formal way, this is a nice, neat, clean statutory interpretation question. But of course, it's not so simple as that. In a very important way, and this goes back to the quote from Gymnastics that you gave before, Obergefell as a constitutional decision stood pretty clearly for the principle that lesbians and gay men, and by extension sort of others in the LGBT communities, are entitled to first-class citizenship status and rights. On this view, if a straightforward reading using the traditional tests of Title VII would include in the ways that we were talking about before, include anti-gay and anti-trans discrimination, then it looks to be a form of exclusion. It looks to be a form of discrimination to refuse to take the principled readings and forms of interpretation, understanding what sex discrimination is, and pull LGBT folks out of those traditional protections. In other words, if the tests, as they traditionally work, include LGBT folks, to not treat them the same as everybody else who would ordinarily otherwise be subject to those tests looks like they're being discriminated against by a decision that refuses to interpret Title VII broadly. On that view, a broad understanding or a sort of an open understanding of sex discrimination is more consistent with the principle of first-class citizenship status that Obergefell held LGBT folks are entitled to. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Elena Yoakum, a lot of people think, you know, you just lay people out there, they think that we're talking about special rights. That's a real familiar refrain when we're talking about these kinds of issues. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, we hear that a lot, unfortunately, and it's a deep misunderstanding. It even goes back to Mr. Briggs, what I would call a misunderstanding that this is a zero-sum game. It is not. In fact, we are simply seeking equal protection under the law in housing, employment, and public accommodations for people based on their sexual orientation and their gender identity or expression. No more, no less, including existing religious exemptions that do exist under state law and under federal law. An earlier guest of yours suggested that there were no religious exemptions in the Equality Act. That's also not accurate. Religious freedom is very important. It is enshrined in the First Amendment in Article 1 of the Ohio Constitution. And there are many recognized religious exemptions, all of which would remain in place by simply adding sexual orientation and gender identity as protected categories under our state and federal law. We're just seeking equal treatment, nothing special about it.
Well, what do you think Emma Green of The Atlantic is getting at, though, when she says that the Equality Act that passed in the House didn't include religious exemptions?
It may be referencing that they are not explicitly repeated in the Equality Act, but things like the ministerial exception, which allows for preferring folks of the same religion in certain circumstances, all of that would stay in place.
You're saying it's not necessary to have that language in the Act. Mark Spindleman?
So it
might go a long way to easing concerns, but is it necessary?
Well, I mean, you know, sort of there was a case that was decided by the Supreme Court recently involving the question of how anti-discrimination laws work. And the Supreme Court found that certain proceedings, this is a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop, found that the state administrative proceedings that were moving to vindicate the equality rights of a same-sex couple, that the proceedings themselves constituted a form of discrimination against the religious owner of the cake shop. And in that case, this goes back to something that was just being talked about. The Constitution there was being understood to be operative with its religious protections, or protections for religious liberty, even in the context of anti-discrimination rules. So there are constitutional protections that still persist, as well as the possibilities of statutorily written exemptions, things like ministerial exceptions that can be placed into anti-discrimination laws, either at the state or at the federal level.
Elena Yoakum, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard that Dave Yost, the Attorney General, has said this is nothing against LGBTQ community, Have you talked with Dave Yost? Have you heard back from the Attorney General's office about what their motivation is to joining this amicus brief?
Yeah, I actually had the opportunity to sit down with staff from the Attorney General's office to directly address this because, frankly, we were extremely disappointed at the Attorney General's decision to insert Ohio into this case here by voluntarily joining this amicus brief. The response that we got back is much like the Attorney General's public statement, which says this is really a legal argument. This is not to be meant as something against the LGBTQ community. Frankly, that rings hollow with the fact that if his position were to win at the Supreme Court, it would, in fact, roll back protections that have been enjoyed by transgender Ohioans for over a decade under federal law in these limited circumstances. Of course, we're seeking for full protections, but at least in this one area, transgender Ohioans have experienced protection under the federal law.
Because the EEOC.
That's right, for the EEOC's position. So it would roll that back. And additionally, I would say if the Attorney General is serious about wanting equal protection for LGBTQ folks, then I would expect that he would fully endorse the Ohio Fairness Act and the Equality Act being passed at the state and federal level.
And he has not?
Not to this time, but I'm hoping he's listening.
Mark Spindleman, what's the significance when someone like the Attorney General of the state of Ohio inserts the state into an amicus brief at the 11th hour, really, in August, that goes before the court, the U.S. Supreme Court in October. Can he have it both ways?
So, I mean, I think that there are lots of ways in which it's potentially significant. The most important of which, in a sense, are at the local and statewide level. So, you know, sort of part of this is a question about what stand public officials here, sort of a statewide office holder, is taking on the legal status of LGBT discrimination. And, you know, the idea that the signature on the brief is not meant, you know, sort of to be a knock against lesbian and gay rights is really a hard argument for lots of people to accept. It's like, no offense, but you don't get these rights. But don't be offended. And this is not a position that's actually discriminatory for lots of people. It is because understanding if this brief is successful in what it's arguing for, it will mean that that folks who are lesbian or gay or being discriminated against based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity or expression are in effect being treated differently than they otherwise would be being treated under federal law. And that's to reflect and reinforce an old status as second-class citizens, that we have a broad public discourse grounded in constitutional values saying that's the past and we live now in a new era. Part of what's happening is that there's, in a sense, a relitigation of some of the advances for equality for lesbians and gay men and trans folk where people are trying to relitigate. So it's no surprise that many of the forces that are arguing against the broad understanding of sex discrimination under Title VII are the same folks who are opposing marriage equality and who continue to oppose marriage equality in Obergefell, who were, you know, sort of in the state of Ohio. So there's deep significance sort of statewide. And at the federal level, it's certainly important for the Supreme Court to be hearing from a number of attorneys general on this position. But there are lots of arguments before the Supreme Court, and this is just one of many on both sides of the issue that the court will be hearing.
Again, the Attorney General's office declined our invitation to have Dave Yost or anyone representing the office on this issue join the show today. We did ask. We gave them a lot of time to make arrangements, and they declined our invitation. Sorry about that. Elena Yoakum, what's next for Equality Ohio? I mean, is it just wait and see what happens in October before the Supreme Court? We know the decision won't come until maybe many months later.
Well, we're certainly interested in the result of this case. It's very important to have an understanding of where the patchwork of protections will be after the court decides. But frankly, it doesn't change our trajectory at all. Equality Ohio is focused on passing the Ohio Fairness Act, currently Senate Bill 11, authored by Senator Nikki Antonio, co-sponsored by Republican Senator Michael Rooley. And we will be working to advance the hearings in that bill and hopefully get a committee vote in full passage on the Senate floor.
And Mark Spindleman, we're just about out of time, but I forgot to ask about Justice Brett Kavanaugh. This will be the first major test on gay and transgender rights since his appointment to the court to replace Kennedy What's your sense about that? Have people been talking?
My favorite line still on predictions is he who lives by the crystal ball is bound to eat a lot of ground glass. So I tend not to make predictions. But, you know, if you know, you heard from one of your other guests about what a conservative argument about the original intention of Title VII would lead to and do. What I was trying to talk about was an argument from the text. And there are conservative justices who believe that you should understand the meaning of federal law by reading the text, and on a straightforward reading under established precedents, lesbians and gay men and trans folk are and ought to be protected by Title VII sex discrimination provision. And so it's not inconceivable that you will have conservative justices, maybe Chief Justice Roberts, maybe Justice Kavanaugh, going along. But we just have to wait and see.
Mark Spindleman, professor of law at Ohio State, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Elena Hyokum, an attorney and executive director of Equality Ohio, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.